Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of You Make Me Sick. Today, I have a very special guest, David Dwest. David is a director of the second largest wastewater treatment plant here in the United States. David holds a master's degree in environmental engineering from Northeastern University. He also has a bachelor's degree in chemistry from DePaul University. David also holds a grade 7 wastewater treatment plant operator's license from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. And he's also the co-chair of the Energy Work Group of the National Association of Clean Water Agencies Utility and Resource Management Committee. David's also been awarded with the New England Water Environmental Association's Alfred E. Pelliquin Award. This is an award that recognizes personal service as well as excellence related to operations of a treatment plant and through assistance to plant operations personnel. We're really lucky to have David here. He's going to talk today about the Deer Island Wastewater Treatment Plant that's actually located right outside of Boston, Massachusetts. Services a huge area. I want to talk a little bit about the plant itself because it's a massive operation. And it's actually got a lot of aspects to it that you might not think a wastewater treatment plant would have, including from an environmental aspect, as well as from just producing its own energy. And then we'll talk a little bit, too, just about wastewater surveillance, how that relates to infectious diseases, what's being monitored today, and then touch a little bit as well on kind of some of the byproducts from the plant and how you can actually, you can purchase some of these byproducts I was reading. So a lot of stuff to cover. So I think, first of all, David, thank you for joining us. So the Deer Island Treatment Plant, so it's one of the largest wastewater treatment plants here in the United States. Just how large of an area does that cover?
So we actually cover 535 square miles. We actually take wastewater from 43 different communities in the metropolitan Boston area. It accounts for 2.3 million people that we cover, and it's about 34% of the state's population sends their waste to Deer Island for treatment.
Which, when you think about wastewater plants, like, that's pretty impressive, right? Because I guess the second largest in the United States. So it's just a massive area. I think a lot of people might be wondering, too, what does wastewater consist of? Because everybody, we get up in the morning, and at least here in the United States, in most developed countries, you can go, you can use the bathroom, you can, you know, get a cup of coffee, pour something down the sink. When you think of wastewater, like, when I think of wastewater, I kind of think just primarily of sewage. But is it a mixture of all these different things?
It's a mixture of all those different things. So wastewater comes from residential sources, your home, my home, whatever. But it also comes from industrial sources, from commercial sources. MWRA's water district is also includes five different major cities that send their stormwater through the sewer system. Not the preferred method that we like to see, but they do send us their stormwater. We also get, unfortunately, because a lot of our collection system is from piping that might be over 100 years old, you might get some groundwater infiltrating into the pipe, the sewer pipes as well, that can come to the plant. Almost 35% of our flow is actually attributed to infiltration inflow, so which is that groundwater, stormwater content.
Which is pretty crazy. I've lived in Portland, Oregon as well, and they have it must be an outdated system for their a lot of their sewage, because they had issues. The Willamette River kind of splits the city, and when you'd have heavy rainfall there, you would oftentimes have overflow and sewage overflow into the river, and they would literally shut the river down or tell people not to swim in it in the summertime often because it would rain if you had these, you know, big storms come through. And I'm assuming that's kind of the same. Is that the same type of thing you're talking about with a lot of rainwater coming in? And I know that we do a pretty good job of preventing that here from flowing into the Charles River and other areas, correct?
We try, but yes, unfortunately, because of the five major cities that we have that do contribute combined sewer, stormwater flow to Deer Island, that's nearly the furthest downstream point in our collection system just prior to the treatment plant. So yes, the sewer system can actually get overloaded, in which case any relief points might go out what's known as combined sewer overflow treatment facilities. So, and that could end up in the Mystic River, the Charles River, and the other various rivers, or Boston, or directly the Boston Harbor. So it's We've eliminated a lot of those sources, but we still have about 10% of the CSO flows still being released out the out those combined sewer overflow relief points. 90% of them have been eliminated from 20 years ago, but we still have a ways to go to get rid of them.
Which is, that's a huge accomplishment in of itself, I think. There's even that old Standell song, Dirty Water, that talking about the Charles River, essentially, from, 50, 60 years ago. So I think we've done a great job as far as relative to, like you said, 20 years ago, really kind of reducing that.
That's definitely very true. Yeah, as a matter of fact, they're even considering putting in swimming locations on the Charles River near MIT, MIT Beach, and other things like that that they're talking about because the water quality has improved so greatly in comparison to, say, 20, 30 years ago.
Which is fantastic for everybody, I think. So with all these kind of different inputs that you said, and you also service industrial sites, are there ever issues with industrial grade chemicals getting mixed in? And is that something the plant's able to actually kind of filter out?
So the most important thing is that any industrial sources have to be registered in order to connect to our sewer system. Then they have to be permitted. Then they're required to do certain monitoring on their own. As well as provide us a full inventory of all the chemicals that they actually use at their facility. We then audit those and take additional samples ourselves to make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. But yes, we can't be over their shoulder every single minute of the day. There is a possibility that someone could release something down the sewer that isn't quite there. The good news is that we have a number of monitoring points further downstream, including air monitoring as well as dissolved contaminant monitoring locations. We'll also do continuous monitoring at the treatment plant. So we can detect a lot of these chemicals if they're coming through our system. So that's one thing that we try to stay up on as well.
If you had one particular offender, would you be able to figure out who that offender is just by possibly the different chemical compounds they're putting in? Or is it hard to tell once it's kind of all mixed in where specifically it's coming from?
So one good thing, so we have a group called the Toxic Reduction and Control Group, and they keep track of all those industrial permits. They know exactly what contaminants are used or chemicals are used at each of those facilities. If we detect something in the sewer system at any one of our pump stations or headworks facility or even the treatment plant, we can actually backtrack that further upstream. We know our sewer system very, very well. We know who has these chemicals in their existence, and we can backtrack it. And usually we can identify the source of those contaminants.
Which is actually really cool. It puts accountability on a lot of these businesses to make sure they're doing what they need to do. So I kind of want to get into the treatment process now. So there's the treatment plant itself services just a massive volume of wastewater. I think I was reading it can service up to 1.3 billion gallons a day,
to put into context,
I think that's like almost 2,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools full of waste every day. Just for our listeners to, and it's also, I think, twice the size of Walden Pond here in Massachusetts by volume. So just a massive amount. I was wondering, once, we're getting all this waste from different sources, if you might be able to explain kind of the different steps once the wastewater reaches the plant. I know there's like a primary, a secondary, and then disinfection. If you might be able to just kind of touch on those for our listeners and explain maybe each one of the steps and how they work.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, we have several levels of treatment, primary, secondary, disinfection, dechlorination, and then release out the outfall. And then we also have ways to treat the material that we remove from those different treatment processes. So we use a number of different physical, biological, and chemical treatment options. Primary treatment essentially is it removes the settable solids using gravity as a physical form of treatment. We just slow the flow down, let the material either settle or float to the surface. We take that material off. we send that over to the residuals part of the plant for further treatment. Secondary takes the effluent from primary, which is the material that was treated from primary, and it goes through a biological form of treatment where we remove the dissolved organic material that could later deplete oxygen in receiving waters if we don't remove it before we release it out the effluent. We also destroy all the pathogens that come into the plant and reduce that by over 50%. The added benefit is more solids removal. By the time it leaves secondary, we can actually see 94% of the contaminants that came into the plant removed, which is pretty impressive.
That really is.
The final step that we do on the water side is disinfection and dechlorination. And one of the most important steps to any treatment plant in the country is pathogen elimination. So you don't want to get these pathogens released into the environment that will eventually either end up in the ocean, drinking water sources, or the fish in shellfish that we eat. So we actually disinfect our wastewater with sodium hypochlorite, which is a stronger form of bleach that you would use at your in your house. We buy it 3 times more concentrated than what you get it at. We use about 5,000 gallons of that every single day on an average daily flow. Then the next most important step that we do is we dechlorinate that that and get rid of any residual chlorine that might be remaining in the effluent prior to it being released out the outfall. And the reason why we do that is because the chlorine can actually be just as toxic as any of the other chemicals that came in with the plant influent. As a matter of fact, it can cause fish kills. So it's critically important to eliminate that chlorine before we release. And then we can talk about the residual side in a few minutes.
So kind of going back to the secondary treatment phase, I know that you use a, I think it's a pure oxygen activated sludge system. And I think there's also microorganisms involved in that. And the plant itself physically, the way it's built is pretty impressive. And you have these giant digester eggs. So if anybody who's listening, just look up the Deer Island Wastewater Plant. You can kind of Google a picture of it and you'll see it. And it's very distinct in the way it looks. These digester eggs are, they're about the size of like a 10-story building, 90 feet in circumference. And I think there's, do you have a dozen of them? How many?
Yeah, we have a dozen of those eggs. And that's for the residuals, the remaining residuals that we removed from primary and secondary treatment. We send all of the sludge that we've removed from the wastewater, put that into those big eggs. The material will sit in those eggs at a fairly high concentration, and they sit in there for anywhere from 25 to 30 days, and we get more than 50% solids destruction. We get a beneficial product known as a biogas that we can actually use to heat and power our facility. That gives us a benefit of about $26 million a year in benefit. That's huge. And any remaining residuals that come out of that process get converted to a fertilizer that we later land apply. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes.
Yeah. Do you happen to know offhand, just for our kind of biology fanatics, what the microorganisms are used in the digestion process in the eggs?
Yeah, so it's a multi-stage process that's actually going on continuously, and it's a balance of different microbes that are doing acidogenesis first. So in other words, you get a lot of material that is essentially remains of the human diet. So fats, proteins, carbohydrates, lipids. There's a certain amount of bacteria that will actually break it down into organic acids. And then there's another series of bacteria that will feed off of those organic acids and break those down even further into methane, carbon dioxide, and water, and hence the biogas that we want. So we want the combination of all these different microbiological processes to be in balance so that we can get the ultimate benefit, which is the solids destruction, which reduces the volume of sludge that we have to handle in the future. And also that beneficial biogas that we want to use in our green energy production.
Which is pretty impressive. Do you know if there are other wastewater treatment plants that use this same type of mechanism for their waste?
So interestingly enough, there are about 17,000 treatment plants in the country. Only 9% of them actually use anaerobic digestion, and only about 50% of those actually beneficially use the biogas. So we're a little bit unique. I've been trying to spread the word on the value that we see at MWRA. There have been a number of different plants that have reached out and connected with us, and so that we can help them improve. And then there are also a number of different treatment plants internationally that have contacted us as well to try to, and we end up being the model of what they're trying to shoot for green energy production. And, you know, pre-COVID, I actually met with five major provinces from China. That the smallest one was 12 million people. They're trying to go from essentially a third world nation to a first world nation overnight. They have to build all these different systems, including sewer systems. They didn't have these things to begin with. Environmentally, they were very backwards. So, but they're trying to. I published a few papers that get picked up in a Chinese news article. They contacted me, and 2019 was a banner year for touring a bunch of Chinese visitors internationally.
So it's pretty impressive. The plant itself is. Do you know if the Deer Island plant was the first plant to really institute this scale of kind of using that anaerobic digestion, as well as the other innovations which we'll talk about that the plant uses?
No, unfortunately, we're not the only ones, and that's a good thing. There are a lot of larger treatment plants that are in our category. There aren't that many of them, but there are, and they actually they think about ways to help improve their operation as well. Chicago, Detroit, D.C., L.A. County, in the Hyperion area. They've all implemented different variations of this. A lot of the process decisions and technologies that people choose is based on the space availability of a facility. If you're building in the middle of a large city, you might be restricted on the land area. Deer Island, we built it on an island. We took over the entire island, which is still connected to the land through the town of Winthrop. But we were restricted on the technologies that we could choose based on the space availability. We couldn't grow the island to expand to do larger things. So there are a number of space-saving technologies that we chose. In our primary and secondary clarifiers, we use stack clarifiers, so one on top of another rather than side by side. We use a pure oxygen activated sludge, so we actually extract oxygen from air, concentrate it from 21%, which is in air, to 95%, so that we can do effectively the same amount of work in one-fifth the space. We use a portion of our outfall as a contact basin so that we can get the added benefit reduce the amount of square footage that we have to dedicate to tank space. We decided to go with anaerobic digesters that were egg-shaped using the height rather than the width. A traditional pancake-style digester would be a lot flatter, would only be 30 feet tall at the tallest point. It could be 300 feet wide, though. If we tried to pick that technology over an egg shape, we would have filled our entire southern end of the island and not been able to put any other residual treatment in it.
So it wouldn't look as cool either.
It does look a lot cooler. and they are quite readily, the symbol of Boston Harbor's recovery. When we, before we built this plant, Boston Harbor was considered one of the dirtiest harbors in the nation. And now we have some of the cleanest urban beaches in the country. And I'm talking about in comparison to California, Hawaii, Florida. It's just an impressive feat where we've gone in just 30 years.
It really is. I remember even from 20 years ago living around here, it wasn't even as nice as, you know, people would, if you were going to go to the beach, you didn't go in Boston. You would actually go out of the city to go find a beach somewhere else, either the North Shore or South Shore. So,
yeah, the interesting thing is that, you know, when I first came here, if you did go in out in Boston Harbor, almost nothing was living in the harbor. You looked at the sediments and the sediment was dead. It was like black mayonnaise. To quote a researcher that we had, nothing survived in it besides this anaerobic worm. Just in 30 years, by preventing pollution, that we've been, so we actually didn't clean up the harbor per se. We stopped polluting it and let nature take its course. Now we're actually seeing things like eelgrass return to growth in the harbor. We didn't plant it. It just came back naturally. We're seeing microorganisms come in that are attracting whales. I'm sure you saw the stories this summer with the whale that was breaching left and right in Boston Harbor over the course of a 2-week period. I think that's the fourth or fifth year in a row that we've had whales in the harbor. We routinely see harbor seals, and we've even seen some dolphins in the harbor recently, which is impressive. You know, that would never be that way, because everything in the harbor was dead. They wouldn't come in here. They know they're not going to get any food in here. Now it's the opposite. They're actually seeing the microorganisms that are in a healthy water system actually growing in a good population in balance, and we're seeing them return naturally.
Which is actually, it's a good lead into my next question that I have, because with the massive volume that you do every day, that effluent, so essentially it's the water byproduct, the liquid byproduct after everything is done, that goes right back into the Massachusetts Bay. I was wondering if you could kind of describe the outfall tunnel. It's a massive tunnel just to handle that huge volume of water. And just how is that safely distributed into the bay without, and when it does reach that point, you know, what's the purity level of the water compared to from where it started?
So, yeah, Deer Island does have a very unique outfall. It was actually modeled after the Sydney, Australia outfall, which is about 6.5 miles in length. Our outfall starts at Deer Island, drops down a drop shaft about 450 feet straight down. It's about 30 feet in diameter, that drop shaft. And then the outfall is actually 9.5 miles, 22.5 feet in diameter. It's about the size of the Callahan Tunnel, to put it in perspective, without the road deck and the ceiling. So it's a huge tunnel. The tunnel alone holds about 160 million gallons of fluid, which is half a day's flow. The whole goal of that tunnel, though, was really to provide dilution to minimize any potential impacts on treated effluent when it goes into the receiving waters. Not that the solution to pollution is dilution, but it can help. And remember, the treatment plant is providing about 94% removal of all contaminants. So it's already pretty clean as it is, but now you add in dilution on top of it. One of the unique points is it's not one single end of pipe on this outfall. At the end of that 9.5 miles. Over the last mile and a quarter, about every 250 feet, there's a riser that brings the treated effluent from that tunnel to the seafloor with a diffuser that's actually built on top of that. That diffuser then has 8 different ports on it. We open up 5 or 6 ports, and that helps distribute the treated flow over that mile and a quarter, so we get massive dilution. Most treatment plants, they're lucky if they get a 10 times a dilution. We're seeing a minimum of 70, and we're typically closer to 350 times dilution. So that's wow. even if we put out a poor quality effluent, you probably wouldn't see any impacts because of the dilution. But add the fact that we have a very high quality effluent because of our treatment process, coupled with the dilution, you're seeing no impacts whatsoever, which is a great thing. So the outfall, that diffuser is installed about 110 feet of water. The other thing to think about with that is the reason why we only activate 5 or 6 of the ports was because the design engineers actually provided us a plan for climate change. So let's say 100 years from now, we get sea level rise, 2.5-5 feet. Well, we can open up additional ports on that diffuser, on those individual diffusers, and recover all of that capacity, no matter whether there's 110 feet of water or 130 feet of water. So we could easily recover that capacity just by opening up additional ports without any cost or construction. It's a great thing because that they actually were so forward thinking on that.
Yeah, kind of thinking for the future. It's actually fantastic. So that's kind of where the effluent went. Kind of getting back to when you have the solids too. So you have that solid sludge that's kind of left behind. And you guys also do something that's incredibly unique. You actually have a pellet processing plant for fertilizer. If you could touch on that briefly.
Yeah, so there's a couple of different things. So when with that 360 million gallons of flow that we treat on an average day, we get in about 260 dry tons of solid material. So in other words, that's the solids that people flush down the drain and ends up at the treatment plant. When we put it in anaerobic digestion, we're actually getting about 60% solids destruction typically, always greater than 50%. What we're left with is about 100 dry tons of solid material in a liquid form that we then pump to our pelletizing plant, where we convert that material to a nitrogen, phosphorus, carbon, organic fertilizer. So by organic, I mean it has a lot of carbon still remaining in it. It's still about 50% carbon. Now, carbon is a great source as a soil amendment. It helps improve the quality of the soil that you apply it on. It also helps retain water. So in other words, if you place this fertilizer down on your soils, you will have to water that soil less. The other thing is that most artificial fertilizers that are high in nitrogen and phosphorus, if you water that in, that will just it potentially could just run off and go into rivers and streams and cause biofouling. And algae growth. The beauty with our biosolid fertilizer is that nitrogen and phosphorus is bound within the organic material. The only way it can be released is by biological action of the soil, naturally in the soil. So it actually has to physically be in the soil, and then the biology of the soil actually has to break down that material. So it's not going to run off. It's not going to contribute to algae blooms in those rivers and streams. And it's going to improve the organic content of that soil and really improve its quality.
So with these, once they're they're made into pellets, made into fertilizer, can these be purchased by the public?
It can. We actually market this product as Bay State Fertilizer. You can actually purchase this directly from the pellet plant. If you go on MWRA.com, there's links to how to purchase fertilizer. We sell it at $4.50 a bag, and it's a 40-pound bag. Typically, we prefer to sell it in one-ton increments because it's easier to move the product. But we also mostly sell the product in bulk form anyway to large farms and soil amendment. They could be turf farms. It could be a number of different landfill recovery. It could be a lot of different purposes, golf courses, etc. So most of the sales are in bulk form. So we'll actually send out rail cars or very large trucks actually filled with this material. Or we bag it and sell it individually.
Do you know just offhand how many tons of the fertilizer is created either each day or each week or per year?
Yeah, I do, unfortunately. I know all of that information. So we produce about 100 tons of fertilizer every single day, about 34,000 tons every single year that get marketed as Bay State Fertilizer. So it's a very large product. To sell, and it gives us a good avenue. It's better than putting the material directly in a landfill and contributing to greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic use of the byproduct for it. I think a lot of people might be wondering, while this whole process is going on, from the time that the wastewater gets to the plant to the end, how bad does it smell there? And is there anything that you guys do at the plant to kind of mitigate the smell?
Well, you know, the good thing is that Deer Island took that into consideration when we designed and built the plant as well. All of our tanks with the odorous portions of the treatment process are covered. We capture all the odorous off gases of wastewater treatment and put it through odor control before we release it back to the environment. So we actually, the biggest odor, obviously, is that rotten egg odor that most people typically associate with a wastewater treatment plant. And that's known as hydrogen sulfide. So we treat that in a chemical wet scrubber where the air will go through, chemical rain comes down, and we'll extract and then oxidize the hydrogen sulfide to sulfate. And then that gets recycled back to the front end of the plant. The air continues on for a polishing step where we send it through activated carbon. So not only does it get that wet chemical treatment process, it also goes through activated carbon, where it removes any remaining hydrogen sulfide, but also any potential low concentration solvents that might have been put in the waste stream as well. And all of that has to comply with what's known as a Title V air permit that EPA and DEP issue jointly. That controls our actions in those odor control facilities as well. On top of that, we do have generation facilities as well, using backup generators and other combustion emission type sources. Those also are covered under our Title V permit, and we're required to meet very strict, stringent limits on those as well.
So the plant in itself is not completely self-sufficient, but you guys use a lot of your own byproducts for heating the plant, for energizing the plant. I know that beyond the digesters, there's also, I think you have steam turbines, and then there's hydroelectric that you use, as well as wind turbines kind of right outside the plant. I think I read that there's solar as well. How much of the energy that the plant actually creates on its own are you guys able to harness and use for your own, your own energy and heating needs?
So if you look at a combination of heat plus electricity, we produce about 65% of Deer Island's energy needs on island. The bulk of that is from digester gas. Hydro, wind, and solar are other options, but they're a much lower percentage. With that said, we're also looking at ways to even improve upon that. We're going through a new design for a replacement combined heat and power system that will take our current energy production and actually increase it, and we could get 85 to 90% off the grid, which is an impressive feat for a plant this size. We're trying to get the biggest bang for the buck with all the green energy sources that we have. And our biggest value is in the value of digester gas, which comes from anaerobic digestion.
It's amazing. As a taxpayer, I love that too, because it's less less money.
The biggest thing is, like I said, that digester gas saves us about $26 million annually. Right now, we have about a $65 million a year current expense budget. Without that, it would be $26 million more. We'd be talking about over $90 million a year. So it does save our ratepayers money by taking the benefit of that biogas and using it on site.
So with regard to plant operations, we've kind of, now that we know where the byproducts go to, how the plant actually works, I know I was reading, like, there are a couple of different systems that actually help kind of regulate each step throughout the plant. Process information system, and then the operation management system. And these are pretty unique systems in and of themselves. And for a plant this size, how do you monitor such a large plant with so many different steps to make sure that everything is adequately being controlled?
So, you can do it a couple of different ways. You can employ a lot of staff to do that put them all out in the field and have them watching it. Or you can use what's known as a industrial control system, which is a plant automation operation that allows you to collect all information from field instrumentation like flow meters, valve control, on-off switches, other things like that, where you can actually control a piece of equipment, turn it on or off, We have one of the largest industrial control systems in the country. You measure a control system based on the number of input-output points to that system. We have about 30,000 points to our system. Just to put it in perspective, a large nuclear power plant, and we're talking about ones that make $1 million every single day in energy production, those will typically have 5 or 10,000 points in their system. So we're actually more automated than, you know, a highly technical nuclear power plant. Without that control system, instead of currently having 250 employees, we'd probably be more like 450 and 500 employees that we'd have to employ to watch this system. The other important things is that because we have this system with alarming capability and reporting, we can deploy people a lot more efficiently to areas of the plant, knowing that something might be amiss in a certain area of the plant based on the alarms that are coming in that control system. And we can deploy people appropriately. And it helps improve our efficiencies immensely.
Considering the complexity and the size of the plant, how much training is required to actually operate these systems? Is this something where you have, you know, separate teams for each system? Is it all managed by one kind of one subset?
We have a very wide diversity of different disciplines out there. We have blue collar workers with between electricians, plumbers, HVAC, instrumentation techs. We have wastewater treatment plant operators. We have steam operators. We have managers, facility specialists. We have a number of different groups and disciplines that are represented here. It's a nice broad section of all different types that you'd want to get, that level of expertise. Each one of those disciplines requires a certain certification or license. We will pay our employees to maintain those licenses, to get the renewals on training that they need to maintain those licenses. We encourage a lot of discussion across all areas of the plant so we can improve the operation. You know, people come in with different backgrounds and different levels of expertise, and everybody has a great opinion on how to improve things on a day-to-day basis. You could have seven different people with seven different opinions, and eventually you're going to get a great solution out of it if you pay attention to what they're doing. And our key thing is hiring highly qualified individuals and then keeping those people, encouraging them to stay. And then it's interesting because most of our staff are long-termers. As an example, I'm a 34-year employee at MWRA. During my time here, I came in with a bachelor's degree and I got my master's degree. And then I added experience in computer science and other things to enhance my control system knowledge and reporting knowledge. It definitely helped pay, and a lot of people do the same thing. They advance their knowledge because it's an interesting place to be, and it's got a great mission. We love our mission here, which is mainly to protect public health and to protect the environment.
So you had mentioned kind of computer technology. A lot of people are talking now about artificial intelligence, how it can be implemented in almost every aspect of our lives. Do you ever see a day, or is there any talk about adding AI as far as working maybe for kind of data aggregation or some other aspect at the plant related to kind of just, I don't necessarily know how you would use it.
Do use it in some way, manner, or form with a lot of post-analysis evaluations of incidents. We also have predictive capabilities. That based on how looking at the historical data of how a pump may operate, coupled with vibration and other conditional monitoring techniques, We can actually use that information to predict when a piece of equipment might fail in the future, so we can plan further in advance to try to figure out, we can better budget and control the spending. Obviously, when you're maintaining a facility this large, if you have to do emergency repairs on equipment, that's going to be a huge cost, and it's not going to be cost effective because you're going to be in a rush to try to replace that equipment. Some things you might not be able to get in a rush way. A lot of our equipment is so large at a facility like Deer Island that it might take 6 to 10 months to just to buy a new pump at one of our largest pump stations. It's 30. It has the capacity to pump 150 million gallons a day. And it draws 3.5 megawatts of power as it's operating. That's not a pump that's on the shelf. So you have to plan for these things in advance. So the more you can use predictive measures, and AI is important in that, taking all the different inputs into the system, evaluating it, and then predicting future failures, you can figure that out better in advance and have a better tight control on your budget as well.
So with regard to public health, I know that I was reading there's a laboratory on site. I just kind of want to talk some about the laboratory in of itself and then also about wastewater surveillance. So the CDC, actually, they recently released a survey regarding wastewater surveillance, and it revealed that almost 75% of those who were surveyed supported wastewater testing. And that of that 75%, 95% of those would actually take preventative measures based on the results of wastewater. The laboratory there, do you guys do your wastewater sampling there? Do you send it out? Is that something that...
We use a combination of testing on site as well as contract laboratory services. So the bulk of the testing is actually done in-house. We have one of the largest environmental laboratories in the state. On site at Deer Island, we have a number of other laboratories dispersed amongst the rest of our water distribution system. They do all of our testing associated with the treatment plant, performance testing, compliance testing. They do our industrial monitoring testing. They do other harbor and bay water quality testing to evaluate the impacts of the discharges of Deer Island's treatment. And they also do a lot of the testing on the water distribution side, which is important. All in all, I think they do about 400,000 analyses per year. Now, as far as you mentioned wastewater surveillance, specifically for viruses and other things, we were actually one of the earliest adopters of a third-party contractor, which is an MIT offshoot known as BioBot. That provided COVID virus testing during the pandemic. It actually started, they approached us in advance of the pandemic with an idea of how to test for different things. It wasn't necessarily with COVID, but once COVID hit in March of 2020, they actually said we can use our testing technique to actually quantify the COVID virus within the wastewater. And they spent the next couple of months doing testing on our wastewater, and they found that they could actually do a good correlation with the testing that was being done by the Department of Public Health and health agencies, coupled with what they're seeing in our wastewater. Think about it. Wastewater is unbiased. It's going to test everybody that might be releasing shedding COVID virus or any other types of virus cells into the whatever gets flushed down the drain. So once they had enough information and they correlated that with the prevalence of COVID in the population, they could then take that information and then directly correlate it with the real the real prevalence in the population. And they, I'm sure you probably noticed it, but they quoted a lot of our wastewater testing on COVID virus between 2020 and 2023, almost every single week or month, saying, okay, there's, you're seeing an uptick in COVID in Deer Island's wastewater, which is evidenced by 34% of the population of the state. We've recently just expanded that testing, and we have another third-party contractor that's actually testing for influenza A and B, RSV, norovirus, and other types of viruses as well. And that's becoming valuable information. You know, when you don't have a lot of testing on individuals, the next best thing is to go to wastewater, which is unbiased and looking at the entire population, not just individual people.
Yeah, you send me the link to that second party. I think it's a wastewater scan is who you use. And for our listeners, if you're curious, you can go to wastewaterscan.org, and they actually have a dashboard. And the dashboard, depending where you are in the United States, you can select your region, and then you can get specific wastewater treatment plants, and it will actually give you the numbers. I think they have 11 different pathogens that they check for right now, or I don't know if all of them test for it, but it ranges anywhere
The other interesting thing about that testing is that the prevalence of those types of viruses is so low in the wastewater, it makes it almost impossible to detect in the actual wastewater. But they develop techniques through their own testing that they can actually look at the sludge that we remove from primary and secondary treatment as a more concentrated form, which would allow them to better detect those viruses. And what they found is that's actually giving them very good information. So that's what you're actually seeing when you go to that website.
So wastewater in of itself, because of COVID, it's kind of brought, shed a little more light anyway to the usefulness of it. There's a researcher and scientist from the area named Sam Scarpino, and he's co-founder of Global.Health. And they're an agency that tries to aggregate data to have almost real-time epidemiological data distributed to everybody. And he's a huge proponent just of wastewater testing. And it's something that's pretty interesting, especially with H5N1 and how there's just a huge, over the past, 10 to 12 months in the United States, we've seen it grow from being in just smaller areas. And now it's very widespread, especially in the middle of the country to the West Coast in dairy herds. There have been a few cases in humans that have come in contact with these. I think there's only been one human to human case so far, but it's something that could possibly help prevent or at least shed light if there's another pandemic starting to spread or another pathogen that we're not really concentrating on outside of the scope of, select cases. Wastewater could certainly be a great way to kind of pinpoint where that stuff is happening. So I think it's fantastic. Did you guys, when you said that kind of MIT came to you guys first, at what point did state health agencies get involved during COVID to track your data? Or did you guys go to the Massachusetts State Health Board of the CDC and say, hey, we've got a way to track COVID. Was it something that that you guys implemented, or was that something that these health agencies came to you for more information on?
So like I mentioned, so BioBot, the MIT offshoot, actually approached us with a potential for doing certain types of testing. Originally, they were actually talking about illicit drug detection. When COVID hit, they expanded it directly to COVID. They proved that their technique could actually work. That took a couple months to confirm. Once they actually got that confirmation that it was actually representative of what's actually in the population, that's when we approached the Department of Public Health, at the state level, and talked about, this is a really valuable bit of information. It's something that you should consider. And they have since adopted it as their mainstay. COVID is, while it's not passe, it's still prevalent in the population, and it keeps on varying its structure. But they're still able to test for it. By providing that information, especially with the lack of actual bulk testing out in the general public, it's the only information that our Department of Public Health has nowadays. The good news is that when they proved the technique in our area, BioBot actually approached other major state agencies across the country And I think at last count, they were over 300 different wastewater plants. I think they might be even significantly more than that at this point. So they were getting a good cross-section across the entire country.
Really cool. It's just a cool technology. And I love that we can, you know, just thinking of, you know, using waste to try and detect disease. It's actually really cool.
Yep.
So I guess kind of the last thing I'll kind of touch on here is kind of plant access. So if you live in the area, I know the plant does give tours. For those who are interested, you could kind of just give a little information about the actual plant tour itself.
So a lot of this information is on MWRI.com. So I definitely encourage you to go to our website. We have an extensive tour program. We typically see about 3,000 people tour this plant annually. The goal of the tour program is to educate folks on what we do, how we do it, and to promote environmental programs. The program is really a chance to reinforce our transparency. We are a state agency. People like to see the value in what they put their money into. All of our money is derived from our ratepayers, which are the towns and cities that we serve. So we really want to make sure that they see that there is value to the water and sewer bills that they're paying into every single month or quarter. We love people to see what they're getting for their bills. We offer tours from March to late October, business days only, typically, when we have the most number of staff on site. Nadia Keynes-Thomas is actually our tour coordinator, and she can arrange tours. We offer general plant or general general tours to the general public. We also offer very specific tours to people that want to talk about very specific things. We have a lot of engineering firms, a lot of schools, both at, it could be starting at high school, colleges, et cetera. We work together with a lot of the colleges in the area to promote, it could be environmental law, it could be environmental programs, et cetera. All of those are different focuses on tours that people will come out and see the plant. It is a marvel. It's, like I said, it's the second largest plant in the country. Not everyone in the country has access to something of this great value. And it's really something to see. And when you're flying in and out of Boston, what are you going to see when you fly out of Boston? You're going to see our very big plant with our very big eggs. A lot of people say, what is that? What is that? So you can actually come out and get a tour. Separate from the tour program, we are a publicly accessible site. We're 210 acres, 160 acres inside the fence associated with a treatment plant. That other 60 acres is dedicated to public access. You can park out at the site. We have 2.6 miles of continuous trail that go around the entire treatment plant. You say, why would I come out to a treatment plant to exercise? It's actually, you mentioned it, odors. Well, because we're all under odor control, the treatment plant is actually just all beautiful views with no odors. And we encourage people to actually come out and see that. You can see it from outside the fence, or and if you like what you see, you can arrange a tour and come inside the fence and actually get a tour. So it's something that I want to encourage people to do.
Yeah, it's really cool. So in a recent episode, we had a researcher, and she's a bacteriophage researcher, and she was talking about, and it's kind of the inspiration for my getting in touch with you, is she was talking about the treatment plant and how she was at Harvard, and they actually went to the treatment plant to collect samples that they were going to be researching. And she said that treatment plants, it's a gold mine for biologists just because of everything.
It certainly is.
So, Sean, if you're listening, thank you very much for mentioning that, because that was really the inspiration for me looking more into the treatment plant and asking, a guest to come on and talk about it. So, David, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. All the fantastic information. The Deer Island plant, it really is a marvel of engineering, environmentally and technically as well. And it's fun to find out, where does your poop go after you flush it and what do you do with it? And to realize that you could, you can buy a bag of fertilizer and who knows, maybe you're fertilizing your own garden. So
here's the last plug that I want to give you. So the treatment plant cost us $3.8 billion to build between 1990 and 2001. The original estimate for the project was $6.5 billion. So we're actually one of the few state agencies that actually came in on a major project and came way under budget. We built during when construction was very limited and the economy was not doing quite so well. So that helped keep our costs down. But it's an amazing thing to think that we did such an incredible job with such a high estimate, and we came way under budget. And we continue to keep a tight rein on the budgets. We're very familiar with the pressures that people are under for maintaining their monthly budget. So our advisory board, which oversees our budget, coupled with our board of directors, likes to make sure that they have a four no more philosophy. So they typically will limit our budget and we'll negotiate with them to keep those expenses down and make it very predictable over the long term. And that helps keep our costs down overall. So we're very fiscally responsible is what I'm trying to get at.
Well, like once again, I appreciate that as a taxpayer. So once again, David, thank you so much. Anybody who's listening, once again, it's a Deer Island Treatment Plant. If you're in the area, I encourage you to, if you have the chance, go for a tour. I haven't had a chance to do that yet, but I'm hoping to do it at some point. And David, once again, I appreciate all the work you guys do there at keeping us safe from an infection prevention standpoint, as well as just what you do for the environment as well. So it's a huge win for people in the area, especially people who've probably lived here their whole lives and have seen it change where they have safer places and safer water to go near. So thank you very much for your time. Everybody, thank you again for listening. As always, I can be reached at makemesickpod@gmail.com, or we are on X at makemesickpod or at makemesickpod. And once again, everybody, just remember to wash your hands. Thank you very much. We'll be right back.